Out in here. Nope, he's after my MacBook. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Building the Fastest SQL Servers. I'm Brent Ozar. I'll be your host for today. And I know why you're here. It's just because you found the room with the comfiest seats and the working Wi-Fi. And that's cool with me. I'm okay with that. As long as when you fill out the evaluations, you say, Brent picked the comfiest seats he could possibly find, all for us. A little bit about myself before we get started. My name is Brent Ozar. I'm a Microsoft Certified Master, which just means I made a lot of really expensive mistakes with other people's hardware, and now I get to show you how to avoid some of those mistakes. I'm on Twitter, and you can also email me, brento@brentozar.com. If you come up with any questions out of here today, feel free to drop me a line. The reason that people come and present at conferences like this is because they want to help people. I know when I used to be the attendee, I used to think, oh, I can never email that big fancy presenter. I'm a moron, so it's totally okay to email me. I will not make you look bad. We're going to start out by talking about building the very fastest SQL servers. This is not about building the cheapest SQL servers. I know there are people who say, well, I want to do virtualization, or I want to pack lots of instances on one specific SQL server, or I want to get away with SATA drives in RAID 5. That's cool, but this is not that session. This is about building the very fastest SQL servers. And some of the things I'm going to talk about doing are expensive, like Microsoft SQL Server Enterprise Edition, but I'm going to explain why it's worth it, among other things. Now, I don't know about you, but over in America, we call our very fastest cars SS, and you know what the SS stands for. It's SQL Server. Come on. Not that other thing. No. When I built SQL servers, when I was a database administrator a long time ago last week, when I would build database servers, I thought that I was putting all this careful work in. I would try and exactly measure all of the software that was involved, how many queries were involved, whether or not they used an index to try and figure out exactly how many IOPS I would need. And then I would pour through sites like AnandTech or Tom's Hardware to try and find exactly the right processor that matched my workloads and what kind of memory and what kind of RAID type. And I thought that when I was done, I was building a better environment than any server manufacturer could give to me. I thought I was even improving on the Porsche. I wasn't just buying a Porsche, I was buying it and making it even better. I was wrong. What I was really doing was haphazardly measuring just a few perfmon counters, trying to take a wild, crazy guess, and I thought I'd measure things like disk queue length that really don't mean anything at all. And I found out later, after I would go live without testing, that the users would complain because the software wasn't any faster and SQL Server wasn't any faster. And most of that was because I wasn't really doing quite as good of a job as I'd hoped. So today, we're going to be talking about doing things a little bit differently. The way that Microsoft builds SQL servers. I don't work for Microsoft. A lot of people who attend TechEd believe that everybody who presents here works for Microsoft. Don't ask me to add anything to the code. Don't ask me to give you a discount. They don't listen to me either. I'm just like you. Although there may be people like people who work for Microsoft in here, but Microsoft doesn't listen to their own employees either. This is why I won't get invited back. But the cool thing is that they really review thousands of SQL Server databases. They look at thousands of database applications out there. Teams like the SQL Cat team send rock stars on site to exactly measure different applications. They work closely with hardware vendors because Microsoft wants to beat the other guy. They want to beat that database server that starts with O and I don't know what it rhymes with. But they want to beat them by doing it cheaper and faster. And so they build a lot of tricky specs to maximize throughput, and we're going to steal their hard work. We're going to go look at their reference architecture and figure out how to build those same SQL servers ourselves. I like the way Microsoft and its partners do it, and it's awesome, and I'll show you why, but they're not the only ones who can do that. We can do that as well. So what we're going to do today is we're going to start out by defining the two most common application uses in databases, and I'm going to explain why those two are different, I'm going to explain what you need to buy for each one of those patterns if you intend on making it blazing fast. Then we're going to recognize server designs that we can reuse for ourselves and learn how to test whether we're actually doing better or worse than we thought we were doing. We're going to start with common SQL Server use patterns. I know when I define these two, some of you may have a truly different use pattern. Come talk to me afterwards. But most of the time, it boils down to two. OLTP is online transactional processing. People are constantly doing very small inserts, updates, and deletes throughout the day. This is things like websites, SharePoint, accounting software. And it's stored in a lot of different tables with all kinds of intricate relationships. And these are hard to query because we look and we write these big, long spaghetti queries with dozens or hundreds of joins in between them. The other kind of use pattern out there is data warehousing. Data warehousing, on the other hand, tends to be less numbers of tables, and we only load them overnight. We have these overnight inserts, updates, and deletes that may take a long time, and then when our users query them, they want to keep all of the history in the data warehouse, all of it. They start out saying, well, we only need 5 years' worth of history in the data warehouse. And you know what happens after the fifth year. They say, well, we don't really want to delete it. Let's keep one more year. How bad is it? I go down to vendors all the time and buy a new hard drive for $200. Why do you mean you can't store a little extra in your database server? And at the same time, they won't buy us good equipment for our laptops, though, will they? No. So the two ways, or the ways to really tell which one you have, because sometimes it gets a little blurry, is to listen to what the users want. In the top one, everybody wants their queries instantly. There is no half a second is good enough. There is no 3 seconds is good enough. They want it to happen immediately. Whereas in data warehouses, where we've got years of history, users kind of understand that, well, it's okay if the report takes 15 seconds or 30 seconds to run. I just don't want it to take 20 minutes, which is what it takes now. And the way that we build hardware for these is fundamentally different. Because if I'm going to get a query to finish in less than a second, I can't hit storage. If I'm going to get a query to finish in, say, 30 seconds, I can afford to fetch data out of storage. But if I've got a really small database or a database where I need OLTP, we're going to talk about the right hardware for each of those patterns. I'm going to show you the world's simplest diagram for SQL Server. This is the whole thing with bad illustration talents. This is why I'm not an artist or anything even remotely creative, although I make funny jokes when I present. There's really only four things involved here. There's our end user who asked for a whole lot of data. There's our CPUs who are either going to get it from drives or they're going to get it from memory. Now, if I have a 50 gig table, I am not saying a database for this. I'm going to keep it really simple. Remember our four blocks. And I'm going to pretend that my whole database just has one table. If that one table is 50 gigs, I need to be able to cache the whole thing in memory at any given time. I can do that here with 64 gigs of RAM. I can do that pretty easily. SQL Server Standard Edition is capped at 64 gigs of memory. So anything beyond that, I'm going to have to hit disk. This means if I have a small table, and I say small as 50 gigs, I can afford to cache absolutely everything in memory. I don't ever need to hit disk except when I write to the transaction log or when I update data. But let's talk about what that means. In order to pull off the instant queries, we know that we're going to have to cache all of the data in memory. But in order to get instant simultaneous inserts, updates, and deletes, I need a really fast log file because every insert, update, and delete is written to the log before it's committed, before you get that nice message back saying your changes were made. Now, that means that usually I want to go with solid state drives in a RAID 10 in order to get the fastest logged activity. I know that there's a lot of advice out on the web that says you should put all of your transaction logs on RAID 10 no matter what. The reasoning behind that is that transaction log access is sequential. Microsoft SQL Server starts at the beginning of the transaction log and writes continuously until it gets to the end of the transaction log, and then it runs back to the beginning and starts up again. Hard drives are really fast at sequential operations. So if I put all of the sequential operations on one set of drives, they'll be blazing fast. But how many of you only have one database on your server? It's not a lot of us. We have a lot of databases on our servers, a lot of transaction log files. That's not sequential, because all of your databases are being accessed all the time, inserted, updated, and deleted. It turns into random operations. I will spare you from me dancing across this stage, but imagine, if you will, that I was jumping around between different log files. And sure, I'm stepping forward the whole time, but I'm having to jump around back and forth to different places. The old advice about putting all your logs on RAID 10 on a dedicated array doesn't work when you have multiple databases involved. It doesn't produce as much of a speed impact. If you really want the ultimate speed out of your OLTP databases, they have to be on solid state for the transaction logs, because solid state doesn't have the impact of magnetic drives on rotational or on random access. You know those spinning hard drives? They have a little head moving around inside of them. That's why they're slow with random access. With solid state access, they can write anywhere at any given time. When you're trying to improve the performance of an OLTP database, I want the logs on solid state. And if you're dealing with locking issues, which is something that I don't cover in this, but the best feature for you is SQL Server's read committed snapshot isolation. What this does is every time your database needs to make a write of a record, you're going to insert, update, or delete a record, SQL Server makes a copy of the old record in tempdb. So as I'm making all of these changes in my live data file, I'm logging all of the old records to tempdb. If someone does a big, long query, and they do it with nolock because they think it makes it magically faster, they do it with nolock and they're reading the whole table, but then whenever they hit a point where they see that there's a row that's newer than when their query started, SQL Server automatically fetches it from tempdb, which means my locking problems go away for the most part, even if I don't use nolock. Because as someone's reading through the table, as they see a record that someone has open in a transaction, they can just grab the old version out of tempdb. But there's a catch. Now, all of a sudden, your tempdb is slower. You thought your tempdb was bad. Now, tempdb is like a public toilet. You have no idea what dirty things are going on in there from all kinds of people. It was bad enough when we had those dirty programmers who were writing all kinds of temp table stuff, then SQL Server's using it for spills, SQL Server's using it for sorting indexes. Now it's going to use it for read committed snapshot isolation too. So I'm usually going to want blazing fast tempdb for that as well. Notice what I didn't say. I asked for all this money. I asked for these fast solid state drives in a RAID 10. I asked for fast tempdb data files. I did not ask for blazing fast data files because I'm caching my data in memory. I do have to write it. SQL Server's going to do checkpoints. SQL's going to flush those dirty pages out to disk, but they're not holding back my transactions. My inserts, updates, and deletes are committed as soon as they hit the transaction log, not when they hit the data file. So if I have to save a little money, here's where I'm going to save it. And also, I didn't say this earlier, but feel free to raise questions and ask. I thought I saw somebody raising their hand back there. I think you're crazy. No, it's too early for that question. So what are we going? What does that hardware look like? This is a great example. This is Stack Overflow's taking a picture of their brand new database servers. They're one of my favorite clients because they really, truly get the fast performance thing. 720 gigs of RAM waiting to be installed into two SQL servers. And I know what you're thinking. That's crazy. Only .coms have that kind of money. Just before TechEd, I went and did a price quote because I like to check and see what the market is like at any given time. 384 gigs of RAM. Think about for a second how big your databases are and think about how big 384 gigs of RAM is. Think about how long you've been working to make your SQL servers go fast. Think about the number of hours you've had to listen to some sysadmin or some SAN administrator saying, I'm sorry, RAID 5 is all I can give you. That's got to be good enough. Think about what you would pay to make those problems go away. That 384 gigs of RAM per server is less than $6,000 US right now. That's probably not that much more than what your company paid you to come hang out in Amsterdam for a week and pretend like you're learning. Whatever. Right. So obviously, they don't clap that loud in Orlando. Evidently, you guys are having much more fun in Amsterdam. Woo! So this works, this throwing money at the problem works when we have a really small table. And I don't mean to demean any databases under, say, 100 gigs, but it works when I can cache the whole thing in memory. But once I start getting to the point where the data that I need to cache won't fit in the memory that I can stuff into a server, I do have clients who are running 1 or 2 terabytes of memory in a server just to get blazing fast OLTP. Most people won't do that. Most people can't financially do that. But when we get to this point where the table is going to end up being much more than memory, notice that I've increased the size of my memory here. I've gone up to 256 gigs, and I have to have at least 1 terabyte of space on the storage for my data, but I got a 500 gig table. What happens when I query that table? I can't cache it all in memory. That means at any given time, this query can't finish until I get the rest of that data that's not in memory. So just to use nice even round numbers, say that that's 250 gigs of memory, I'm gonna have to go pull 250 gigs worth of data from storage. Think about how long it takes to copy 250 gigs of data. There is no magic in shared storage. I know the vendors out there on the floor would like to tell you that there's magic pixie dust inside every SAN and they make all your queries go blazing fast. But the reality is we still have to worry about this pipe right here in between our drives and our storage. And we can literally use mathematical formulas to say, how fast can SQL Server accept data from storage? And this is where we're going to start getting some really ugly surprises about how our storage is configured. So this is the exact same slide, but now we're talking about data warehousing, and I can't cache the data in memory. So what I'm going to have to do is maximize storage throughput so that I can quickly get everything that wasn't cached. Now we're going to talk about how do we actually go through and buy that kind of storage. Where do we come up with this stuff? Now, when I used to watch movies, I used to look at cars and go, oh, man, wow, a DeLorean to travel through time. I wish I could rip that off. Thankfully, designing these kinds of servers is much easier. We already nailed down exactly how you would make OLTP fast. There's only one way. You have to cache the data in memory. If we're going to deal with frequent locking, if we're going to deal with big table scans across, say, a 50 or 100 gig table, it has to be in memory. That's the easy part. All we have to do is go 88 miles an hour and buy that really fast memory. Unfortunately, with data warehousing, it gets a little trickier. But here is where we're going to start cheating off of Microsoft. Microsoft's Fast Track Data Warehouse Reference Architecture is probably the best document I've ever read out of Microsoft. Or as I like to say to other people, it's the best document you've never read. How many people have read through this in detail? you people are in the wrong place. You need to leave. You're too smart already. You got all your brains. Or come up here and teach with me. And I use the phrase teach lightly. From this link, you can go download the latest version of Microsoft's Fast Track Data Warehouse Reference Architecture, and it tells you in excruciating detail exactly how to configure your SQL servers, exactly what hardware to buy, how to cable the storage together, how to test to make sure that it's fast, and it is the coolest document to show your boss. Because you can say to your boss and the SAN administrator, this is what Microsoft says we should have for performance. Here is the sad trombone version that we actually have today. We're going to spin through this. So this is a sample framework really destined for vendors. It's not really written for us. It's for Microsoft's partners like Dell, HP, IBM, Siemens, Bull, to go through and build the storage, build the servers, and build the network infrastructure. We're going to use it by ripping it off. We're going to read right through it, and we're going to figure out how to build these servers for ourselves. And my favorite picture out of this document, I'm going to jump out and show you the document here in a second, boils down to this. The holistic component architecture. Boy, you know marketing wrote that, right? No database administrator in their right mind wrote that. And it's really the fancy version of the four box chart that I showed you earlier. Here's SQL Server, which is running on our CPUs. This is our host storage adapter, also known as a host bus adapter. This is our storage switch infrastructure, the fancy pixie dust magic SAN, and the disk arrays that are behind it. We're going to have to measure how fast this can get data, how fast this can deliver data, and how fast this can provide data. And the awesome part is the vendors already did that for you. So we're going to go take a look at one now. So there's a bunch of different ones out there. All of the major hardware vendors run them. Dell, HP, IBM all give these away for free, and they describe how to configure their solutions, but you're going to use it to how to figure out whether or not your solution is configured correctly. Dell reference configuration, they make them for all of the different makes and models, whether you have a 2-CPU server, 4-CPU server. Yes, people actually deploy data warehouses on just 2 CPUs. I'm not going to make you raise your hand because everybody thinks you've got lots of money because you're here in Amsterdam, but how many of you would actually, well, we'll come back to that. How many of you think SQL Server Enterprise Edition is expensive by the core? Well, you're going to be surprised because this thing will handle a lot more storage throughput than you would expect. So it starts out by talking about how you configure the hardware, how you configure Windows, how you configure SQL Server, and then how you benchmark it. And it's beautifully detailed, and I mean beautifully detailed, down to how you configure where you plug each cable in the storage. I try not to throw people under the bus, but your SAN administrator is probably doing this wrong. And I say that because I was a SAN administrator and I was doing it wrong until I saw how this works. They're doing things like cross-connecting the storage so that for every host bus adapter in the server, our server's going across the top, just 2 CPUs. And yet, even though he's only got 2 CPUs, 2 Xeons, he has 2 dual-port HBAs connected to him. If you ask your SAN administrator how much throughput you have to your SAN, I bet it's a lot less than this. And you have to configure it, connect it to different zones on the switch. We have to connect it across different backplanes in the storage array because all of this matters for performance. I'm going to go down a little further. It tells you exactly how to configure every HBA. You know, you often ask things like queue depth or HBA queue depth. What's the right HBA queue depth? Normally, the answer is the default, but not for things like Fast Track Data Warehouse Reference Architectures. It explains what you need to buy, and it even goes down into showing you how to configure the storage. Something on that screen should scare you, because it used to scare me as a database administrator. RAID 5? What? Well, remember in data warehouses, it's often about getting the most throughput for reads. RAID 5 is actually very fast for reads. It's not so good at very quick, very small writes. But remember, if we're going to do very quick, very small writes, that's OLTP. That's a different design pattern. For data warehouses, this is the fastest way to do large table scans. Unless you're made of money, and I'll show you a document for that here in a second. So it tells you exactly how to configure those, and it tells you how to configure SQL Server, which trace flags you should use, which startup switches that you should use in order to get the best performance, things like tempdb configurations, how you do your mount points. And then as we get further down, so this is the version of, see, I'm not the only one who steals from Microsoft. They stole from Microsoft too. This is actually a ripoff of Microsoft's document. And they'd laid it out the same way. The thing on this side over here, we have the server. How fast can this server consume data? And then in the middle, the switch network architecture. And on this side, the storage itself. But the interesting stuff is this right here. How fast can each of these consume and provide data? Those numbers are awesome. A Xeon, pair of Xeons, can consume 3,168 megabytes per second. If you've done any storage testing with stuff like SQLio or Crystal Disk Mark, which we'll talk about later, maybe you're getting 200 or 300 or 400 megabytes per second. Meanwhile, your SQL Server's going, come on already, I got things to do, places to go. And this is why SQL Server seems so expensive at first. We bought too many cores. We went and bought this big four-socket machine with 10 cores apiece because we wanted to have the biggest box on the block. And the real thing that's holding us back in data warehouse is usually storage. So the reason that they call it a holistic architecture is they balance these three things. They say 3,168 megs a second is how much we can consume. The switch network, if I scroll down a little bit, shows how fast the switch network can provide data. Here's why we have to have two of these dual port HBAs. Each one of them is only able to saturate about 1,500, 1,600 megabytes per second. And then for each of our RAID disk groups, they're each able to pull off about 1,500 megabytes per second. So it's about knowing all three of those numbers. There's a really good set of calculations inside Microsoft's FastTrack Data Warehouse Reference Architecture, easy for me to say. There's a really good set of calculations in there that will tell you what your maximum consumption rate is, which is how fast you can actually consume data. I know you're lazy because, again, you're here in Amsterdam for a conference rather than reading books on your own. So I'm going to give you the easy number that I use whenever I'm picking maximum consumption rate. Just start with 200 megabytes per second per core. Now, I'm not dealing with hyperthreading here. That's an excellent discussion in and of itself. But really, if I've got a 20-core system, 200 megabytes per second times 20 cores, I need to be able to saturate 4,000 megabytes per second through storage. And most of us can't do that because we didn't put this much thought and work into our architecture. So let's look at something just a little bit different. I told you I had one for people with all kinds of money. And HP builds small and large versions of this data warehouse reference architecture, but I like this one. Those of you who are hardware geeks probably already recognize what kind of server this is, but we'll go down a little further. So all of these companies, Dell, HP, IBM, all build these. Oh my gosh! You shouldn't be buying one of these servers unless you do this part. This is the important part down here. We have to be able to actually sustain that much storage throughput. And the document goes into detail. I could set that as my background wallpaper. Next time my manager asks me, why is the server so slow? Because you didn't do this. You're fired. You're the kind of guy who goes to Amsterdam. All right, so they also tell you, for example, depending on which kind of hardware you have, you're not going to spend that much money to get that big of an infrastructure. But, it's time for me to appear at the Ask the Expert session, as if I'm an expert. So depending on what model you have, they have detailed specs for this, and they release it every time there's a new version of SQL Server. There are already 2012 guides for this out, as well as 2008 R2. And it shows you, this is what I really love, if I have a data warehouse this big, then this is what I need to buy. It really comes down to just that simple. If I do everything exactly the way I'm supposed to do in the manuals, I can sustain enough throughput to make this worthwhile. And what you don't see is memory. You don't see memory on this slide because memory doesn't matter when the data is too big to be cached in memory. It'll help a little, but the real problem, remember, is I've got to be able to scan the rest of the table as fast as possible. People who buy these systems are happy. I don't know anybody who's implemented stuff like this and hasn't been happy with the performance. I didn't say they were happy with the check they wrote, but they were happy with performance. And I also want to say for a second, so often as a database administrator before I became a SAN admin, I really thought that I had to keep shoveling money into disks. I kept thinking that the real answer was this column right here. I would keep shoving more and more drives in. Oh yes, solid state, give them all to me, let's go. Not understanding that very often it was the connection between these. It was the connection between SQL Server and its storage. So we'll go down a little further here. Shows you how to configure the LUNs. Same difference here, maximum consumption rate. Da, 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 da. That's why you need so many disks when you go with a server this big. And that's why all the connectivity really matters in between your server and your storage. This is why I don't talk about virtualization in this session. I like virtualization. I like it a lot. I've been doing SQL Server under virtualization for years. But it doesn't do a very good job of providing this kind of bandwidth out of the box. You have to do a lot of tuning in order to make this work. Companies who buy virtualization tend to be the kind of companies who buy 1 gig iSCSI or 2 gig fiber channel. And that doesn't come even anywhere close to be able to sustain all of this. Just a quick glance down, it shows you exactly how to configure your database. How many files per file group that you need, because this stuff matters. If I have a whole bunch of RAID arrays sitting over here, and I have a whole bunch of CPU cores over here, they can't just use one pipe to get to all of the data on the other side. They don't use just one cable, even if it's 10 gig iSCSI. 10 gig won't get us that throughput that we were looking at earlier. We're going to have to divide and conquer. We're going to have several cables. That's why these specs ask for dual port host bus adapters. They want lots of cables going between the server and its storage. But the sad part is just because I add more cables between these doesn't mean anything gets faster. If you hook up 10 Ethernet cables to your desktop machine, you don't get 10 times as fast internet. That's not how this works. Traffic will generally just come down one per drive letter. So if you've got a 1 terabyte database and all of the data is in just one file and you're not happy with performance, this is often the issue. We usually have to break those up into multiple files, not because of anything that SQL Server needs. SQL Server doesn't need to break it out, but the SAN does. The storage needs to be able to pass that traffic back across multiple channels. And then, oh man, I wish I had the money to afford something like this. So 15,000 megabytes per second. That'll make quick work of your table scans. Things about max degree of parallelism. Notice we often wonder, how do we set max DOP? What are the right numbers? What does CX packet matter? It actually tends to influence storage as well. So these vendors will tell you what your max DOP needs to be for each type of SQL Server that you have. Queue depth settings, there you go, tells you exactly. This is a change from the default setting of 32. How do you lay out your LUNs? Love that thing. Man, that's awesome. And then how to do multipathing. One of the other things that they say inside that doc is how we test all of this. Because now that we go into all this detail of finding out where the how much CPU power we have and how slow our storage is and how do we get data between these two, well, typically we're going to have to go and look at how fast our CPUs are. And I mean, you've already got the link to those documents to find that out. The important part is that these three are all balanced. So whatever my CPUs can consume, I need to be able to deliver that much storage throughput. SQL Server does a lot more than you think. So if you're not happy with storage throughput, you can use these numbers to help convince your boss as well as what's in the white paper. Here's the other end of that scale, which is how fast all these disks can shove data down through the pipe to the CPUs on the other end of that link. This is a poster that Kendra Little did. You can download from brennozar.com/posters. And it shows the popular interface methods between us and our storage. I really hope you're not using USB. But I will tell you a story. When you test with some of these tools that I'm going to show you in a second, I had one client that I went and tested their storage, and I was so frustrated, I said, look, I'm going to do you a favor. Here's a USB thumb drive. I'm going to double your capacity for throughput right now. Just go plug this in and start putting your SQL Server data on it. They didn't fire me either. It was amazing. Well, they didn't fire me for that. But so the different throughput options that we have, often people will mount SQL Server on just 1 gig iSCSI. If you've been to any of the sessions here at TechEd that have talked about the ability of Windows Server 2012 to use SMB3, which is a much better way of transferring data between two machines, that's cool. It's better than it was. But look how long it takes us just to transfer 1 gig. 8 seconds is a theoretical max. So even if I put in multiple network cards into there, I am waiting for a long time to scan a terabyte. Whereas if I go all the way down to 10 gig iSCSI, 800 milliseconds per gigabyte. Woohoo! That's what I'm talking about. So now we need to figure out how fast our storage actually pulls this off. And this is my favorite tool for this, Crystal Disk Mark. And we're going to talk about how you get it. Notice we were talking about 200 megabytes per core. Look at those numbers. This is for the whole storage piece. Now I'm going to explain these numbers from top to bottom. I'm going to talk about how to run this, but I'm going to talk about what the numbers mean. The first row is sequential. These are long, sustained operations all in a row, start to finish. That is not the SQL Server transaction log file, because you're probably not shoving that much data through it continuously. But what it is backups, index maintenance, DBCCs, update statistics, these long, or of course, table scans, when our users do a select star with no where clause and no index, because that's how they roll. So that is really the number that I'm worried about for maximum consumption rate for the CPUs. So this server would do a really good, this storage would do a really good job of keeping one or two cores busy. The middle two really don't mean anything. The bottom one means a little kind of something for SQL Server. This is 4K random operations. Now, internals guys will point out that SQL Server doesn't use 4K pages. It uses 8K pages. That's cool. I've got a tool for that, too. This is just the easy button for testing, and it's kind of close. 4K operations with a queue depth of 32, meaning this tool is sending 32 operations at any given time out to storage. And they're all over the place in the testing file. This is more like OLTP servers that are jumping around from database to database. Notice the difference in sequential and random operations down here. This is typical for magnetic drives, rotational hard drives. They're really good at sequential, but boy, do they suck at random. Your SAN administrator will say, that's okay, the SAN has a cache. The SAN has its own memory that will cache whatever you need, so even if you're jumping around, we'll probably keep it in cache. Not really, and here's why. SQL Server already has its own cache. It's the buffer pool. Let's say that we've got a really small SQL Server. Man, my perspective has changed since being a consultant. Let's say you've got 32 gigs of RAM in your server. That doesn't sound like much, but it's more than the SAN has. Your SAN will typically only allocate 1 or 2 or 4 gigs of memory per server for caching. If your SQL Server is asking for something that's not in its memory, because you've already got 32 gigs of memory, you're probably using 24 or 28 gigs of that memory for caching. If it's not in here, it's not going to be in the SAN's cache either, because your databases are probably much larger than the SAN's cache. So rotational hard drives, kind of sad story there, but new solid-state drives. This is a screenshot of just one vendor. There's several vendors out there that do it. I think there's one on the expo floor here. Fusion.io, OCZ, RamSan, there's several companies that do this. The newest one that's shown up there, the OCZ Z drive, R4, does 2,000 megabytes per second sustained reads, writes, random, sequential. Anything you want to throw at it, 2,000 megabytes per second. And it's relatively cheap. I mean, it's about the same cost as 380 gigs of memory. And the thing starts at 800 gigs of storage space, goes all the way up to 3 terabytes worth of storage space. And Fusion.io has a similar story there, too. This is why solid-state drives are really changing the game. It's not that your SAN really sucked. We just never configured it right or bought enough drives to begin with anyway. And it's usually cheaper to get the megabytes per second that we need out of this instead of going to shared storage. So how fast is our hardware really capable of going? We're going to have to test our own hardware. And the way that you test a car is that you put it on a dyno. You drive a car up to a mechanic, you hit the gas, and you hope the thing doesn't launch off the ramp. I love watching those YouTube videos of these guys with these cars and boom, right off the ramp. With Windows, we can do just as much damage, and I need to tell you a little cautionary tale first before you do this. Any of the storage testing tools that I'm going to show you can take the SAN down. Not just your part of the SAN, but the entire shared storage infrastructure, anyone else who is storing this data in the same place that you are. In a perfect world, you would run these tools before anybody gets onto the shared storage. In a perfect world, we would also be able to go to Amsterdam and learn things at a technical conference. Well, kind of is a perfect world, come to think of it. So what you'll see out there is a lot of guidelines saying don't do this on a live production server. I will agree you should not do this on a live SQL server that's production because you own those SQL servers. But if you've got somebody else that you don't particularly like that you're sharing the storage with, or if you really never liked the SAN admin to begin with either, what you could do is run this tool, see if it makes the SAN fall over, and then when he comes in screaming, say, well, all I was doing was running a little program. Are you telling me that a program can take our SAN down? That doesn't sound safe. Maybe you should check into that. I don't think I should have SQL Server on that SAN. Because I've done this, and this does reboot some storage controllers. So in order to get started with it, you're going to download this for free from brentozar.com/go/CDM. I didn't write it. I just used my own link shorteners because, you know, link shorteners I can't trust out on the web. The way that we're going to configure it, I'm actually going to switch over and show you live with this. Switch over into my friend VMware here. I didn't say that. I mean my friend Windows. So I've already downloaded it, and it's just an exe that you can install. And what you can do is just save it on a network share. You don't even have to install it on a live server. Just save it on a network share. There's a portable edition. When you go to the download page for this also, it's going to be in Japanese. That's okay. That's where the guys who wrote it are from. They're really smart. That's how those guys work. They make great cars. So I'm going to, not that you German people either don't. Man, I love your cars too, as evidenced by the, I just can't afford them. Man, you got to cut me a break. So we're going to run DiskMark here. And there's a few things that we're going to have to set in here. The three things across the top row. The first thing that I'm going to change is the number of test passes that we're doing. Because I'm sort of in a rush, but not really, because I haven't asked the experts thing coming, I'm only going to do one pass. But if you were doing this on your own storage, you would do, say, 5 or 9 passes because you want repeatable numbers. These numbers can jump up and down as you're measuring them. The second number that we're going to look at is the size of our test file. I'm going to pick the largest test file that this thing allows me to pick, 4,000 megabytes, and then the drive that I want to test. And of course, notice that you need to have enough free space on your drive in order to do the test. It's not too stupid, not too smart there. So we'll go ahead and hit, in order to make this quicker, I'm going to do, say, 1,000 megabytes, and I'm going to click the All button. Now, as it runs, you will see the results come in, and you're going to be able to compare this to whatever's in Microsoft's test guidelines for their fast-track data warehouse reference architecture. 200 megabytes per second is what I want to see per core that you have. Well, wait a second, I'll let this guy start up. Any questions so far, now that I'm waiting on this for a minute? Yes, go ahead. Mm-hmm. This is a great question. So what if you have a SAN with multiple host bus adapters and multiple drive letters across there? Just like the fast track reference architecture recommended you have multiple drives. This is only the easy button for testing, and it only works really for one drive at a time. The next tool I'll show you, you can start multiple instances of it. SQLio, so you can start multiple instances testing simultaneously. This also doesn't work with mount points. Notice I had a drive letter drop down, but it doesn't let me pick specific folders. So if you're using mount points, you're going to have to test those separately. You also want to test every drive letter that you get, because drive letters, even though they have the same size or they're on the same SAN, can be completely different under the hood. As this thing goes on. Any other questions before I go on? No? Oh, yes. Oh, didn't see it. Gotcha. And the lights there. Exactly. Yes. That's a great question. So what about storage tiering? Some vendors, almost all the vendors now, will let you make a 1 terabyte LUN, so it's just big 1 terabyte drive, but it might be some parts on solid state, some parts on RAID 10, and some parts on RAID 5. This is awesome. This is fantastic stuff for database administrators, because I don't know if you've ever played with partitioning. It's kind of painful. It's kind of messy to put different years of data on different drives. Tiering does this for you automatically. So some vendors, it's different. Man, I got to talk with my hands. So some vendors will do it differently. Some vendors will move the whole drive between different parts of storage. Like the whole drive goes between solid state and magnetic or RAID 5. Other vendors will do it on a block by block basis. So if I have a 1 terabyte LUN, whenever I do a write, it goes to the fastest storage. It always goes to solid state. Then the SAN is watching how much I access each of those blocks, and if I didn't access that block in the last week, it drops down to the next slower tier of storage. If I don't use it for another week, it drops down to an even slower tier of storage. As I start accessing this block more and more, it will actually pull it back up to solid state for me. This is fantastic for data warehouses where people are always comparing this month's sales against this month's sales of last year, against this month's sales of the year before that. I need different data hot and quick at any given time, but that keeps changing. It keeps moving around, and I can't set that as a database administrator. But the SAN does it for me. I am madly in love with storage tiering as long as I get transparent reporting from the SAN administrator telling me how busy each tier is. Because what some companies may do is that they'll buy storage tiering, but every time they add a new server, they buy more of the cheap stuff. They buy more space of the cheap drives, SATA, RAID 5, etc. You have to know how busy that first tier is and whether or not you need to buy more. I'm all for that. So for some reason, this thing has decided it doesn't even want to write on my... even want to run on mine, so you guys get the point on that. Oh, it did already, because I forgot I'm using Zoomit. So here's the results off of my lowly MacBook Pro here. I shouldn't have said that. I'm at a Microsoft conference. On my Windows machine. So you, if I was you, I bet a lot of you already have solid-state drives on your laptops, or you know a developer or someone in the group who does. Run this same tool on their storage and use that to compare against your SAN. You will be horrified. I know, because I run this test all the time at my clients and say, you must be pretty proud of that data warehouse that does 100 megabytes per second. Let me show you what my laptop does. And all of a sudden, the SAN administrator is going, well, but you. Yeah, good luck with that. All right, so we'll switch back to this. So this is a quick and easy button, and I like doing Crystal Disk Mark as a just getting started test, but it really doesn't go into quite the depth that I want. So once I've gotten a sanity check out of Crystal Disk Mark that it at least does somewhat good, I start doing much more in-depth detailed testing with SQLio. I've got a very in-depth article on my site about every parameter that you use with SQLio explaining it. You could make SQLio act like SQL Server. But you shouldn't. That's not the point of SQLio. There are tools out there that will kind of fake how SQL Server acts. SQLio is the worst named tool in history because it has nothing to do with SQL and everything to do with IO. It doesn't mimic SQL Server at all, and that's okay because I really just want to throw as much load as I possibly can against the SAN and see how it reacts. Do not run this against a live server. I've seen people actually end up with corrupt data because the SAN was working so hard. But you get to pick the size of the cache file that you want. In Crystal Disk Mark, we were limited to just 4,000 megabytes. That's not good enough. We want to use an even larger test file. Doesn't have to be the size of our database, but it needs to at least be bigger than the SAN's cache. When I run it, there's really only a few things out of this big, long text file that I have to worry about. And there's a stuff in red. IOs per second, this really maps back to a physical disk counter in Windows. People ask, oh, how fast should my storage be? How many IOPS should it do? This is the physical disk reads per second and writes per second counter in Windows. I'm simplifying a little, but it gets you close. So this top one is how much work it's supposed to be able to do. This second one is the one that's usually going to matter more to you. How many megabytes per second can your SAN sustain? Because usually the problem isn't the disks. Usually people already bought enough disks. They just don't have good throughput between their server and the disks. Then the last thing that I would look at as I'm looking at the output of this is that histogram, which shows me how fast in milliseconds my responses came back. In this example, 62% of the time, my results came back in 2 milliseconds. 19% of the time, they came back in 1 millisecond. The way that your results are going to look is that they're all going to be over here, or they're all going to be over here. Because of all the tests that we're going to run, there's going to be a lot of them where your SAN performs great, and then all of a sudden it hits this point where it goes, ah, and all the numbers are over here. Even though all the numbers are over here, your megabytes per second and IOs a second may still keep going up. That's not good. You ignore those numbers because when your SAN starts taking a long time to respond, that's not good enough for SQL Server. And you start running into those infamous 15-second error messages in your event log saying SQL Server waited more than 15 seconds for an IO to complete. That's not good. I want the numbers nice and tight down here. Your goals out of all this testing is to really quickly do a sanity check with Crystal Disk Mark and then try a couple of those tests simultaneously to see if you get more throughput. Then really start pushing it with SQLio, and know how fast each of your cores can be, how much I/O each of your cores can sustain whenever they're pulling data from I/O. But I would be a really bad person if I said that every problem had a fix of storage. I did not talk about any of these things here. These are usually much cheaper ways to improve performance, because you don't get to go home and write a $1 million check in order to make SQL Server go faster. The first thing is that I'm going to want to keep memory free for SQL Server data caching. If you are the kind of person who remote desktops into your SQL Server and runs SSMS, you should skip beers tonight at the Ask the Experts function, and you should go home and study instead. Not really. This is Amsterdam. But what you're going to look at, whenever you want to look at a SQL Server and find out why it's running slow, go into Task Manager, and I'm going to go into the Performance tab. I'll zoom in for you here. So there's a few numbers that are interesting on this. If you're running 64-bit Windows, I bet you've got a really big number right here in cached. We like to think that the memory that is available is what matters. It is not. Whenever the brand new Macs came out, I got all excited and I went to my girlfriend and I said, honey, there's brand new toys. I'd really like to get them. They're available now. And she said, yes, but are they free? I said, oh, no. Just like that, just because your memory is available does not mean it's free. This evil guy here, cached memory, will drain all of your memory dry if you remote desktop in and copy files around, copy trace files, copy ISO files, anything like that that you're doing that's copying files. Windows is using the memory for you, and you will have much less memory that SQL Server can actually use. This is a problem that affects 64-bit Windows. We didn't have this problem in the 32-bit days, but it's very big and important on 64-bit Windows. How do you free this up? Well, Mark Rasinovich, excellent presenter here at the show, has a utility that it can help you with that from sysinternals. But unfortunately, the one most people do for fixing is reboot the server. Yeah. But I'm going to tell you why, even though that's a bad idea, you might consider starting to do it. If you're the kind of person who has active-passive clusters, or even just multi-instance clusters, you might have one instance that's not doing anything. It's been sitting idle for weeks or months, and you remote desktop in there every now and then because it's the passive node. That doesn't hurt anything, right? And we do things from that node. If you go into that node and you look at the cache number, it's insane. I have screenshots of clients with 64, 128 gigs of memory that is all used by the cache because Windows will use all available memory in order to do this caching. And when your instance fails over, when your SQL Server instance fails over to that passive node, there's almost no memory for it to work with. Sad trombone. So one of the fixes that we want to look at is making sure that we've got lots of free memory available. Free memory, not free memory available. We want to design and maintain our indexes, compressed data. This is all old news. But the one that's interesting to me is the last one, Enterprise Edition. Microsoft always touts how much better Enterprise Edition is than all of the Standard Edition. And you kind of go, yeah, well, really? Are you just trying to say that because you like to reach in my wallet so that you can sponsor another conference in Amsterdam? Or do you really mean that? Well, it turns out they really mean it, and I can explain it visually. If I have a 1 terabyte table, this thing is just too big for me to fit into memory. And so when I start a query, I am going to be walking across this table, pulling all of the data through off of disk, because it's too big for memory. I'm going to be pulling it from disk. But because I've only got a small amount of memory, let's say I've only got 200 gigs worth of memory, which is not a small amount, but say if I've only got 200 gigs, as I'm going through and reading this, SQL Server is discarding the pages out of memory behind me because it has to free up memory as it moves forward. I'm not going to have that entire 1 terabyte table in memory at any given time. So as I'm shuffling across that table trying to read the entire terabyte, somebody else comes along next to me and starts running a query too. Microsoft SQL Server Enterprise Edition recognizes and says, oh, you're scanning the big fact table. Let's both hold hands and read along together so that both of us can use the same pages in memory as our queries run. He didn't have to start it again at the beginning. He just read along with me, skipping across the stage. And at the end, when my query finishes, his query goes back to the start of the table and just pulls the data that he didn't get along through in memory without me. Or as I like to call that, SQL Server Type R, Racing Edition. This is the only way that you're able to sustain really big table scans for lots of simultaneous users. Will it work in Standard Edition? No. Each user will be scanning through this individually, and that doesn't scale. So let's talk about the five keys, the most important five things that you're going to use in order to build the fastest SQL servers. First, you're going to start by defining which use pattern you have. Do you need your queries to finish instantaneously, or can you wait 30 seconds for them to finish? If they can wait 30 seconds, then you're able to pull data off of storage instead of caching it in memory. You're going to get the server designs that you can reuse from Microsoft. All of their hardware partners provide these guides to you for free, and they're great reading on planes. Fantastic. Can't get enough of those. I'm not being sarcastic. I love that stuff. That's why I have bad taste in dressing. I read about things like that. We're going to learn how to test our own hardware with things like Crystal Disk Mark and SQL.io. And then finally, just remember that storage isn't the only solution. We still have to do things like index tuning, optimize for concurrency, and do SQL Server Enterprise Edition. And if we do all of those things, then we're going to be a winner or a wiener. So everything that I talked about today, there's also additional hands-on labs. There's downstairs in the hands, or I guess over across the hall in the same hands-on area. There's a lot of interesting labs around SQL Server availability groups, which help us with some of this. And then the last thing that I want to say is, please fill out your surveys. Speakers live and die by those, so take a moment to fill out your feedback forms. Let them know just how bad this American sucked so that he won't have to come back here next time. Because who likes going to Amsterdam, right? Right? Thank you, guys. Feel free to stick around. I will continue to ask questions, but if you'd like to bail, now is your chance to go do so for the Ask the Expert session, or go ahead and I'll start taking questions. But if you're going to leave, thank you very much for your time. Thanks, guys. Thanks.